You're listening to episode 11 of the Book Thingo podcast, featuring lively discussions about romance books, culture, and screwball comedies. This episode, titled The Assumption of Optimism, features Australian author Graham Simsion and was recorded at the Romance Writers of Australia conference in 2015. Book Thingo would like to acknowledge the people of the Kulin Nations on whose land this episode was recorded. We also acknowledge the contributions of Aboriginal Australians to our shared literary heritage.
Welcome to the Book Thingo podcast, talking about books we love, especially romance. Kill a fairy fast on the Book Thingo podcast.
Welcome back to the Book Thingo podcast. I'm Kat Mayer from bookthingo.com.au, an Aussie blog for romance readers. In this episode, I talk to an Australian author whose debut novel, The Rosie Project, has taken the reading world by storm. Graham Simsion was a keynote speaker at the Romance Writers of Australia conference last year and was kind enough to spend some time chatting about books and genre. The Rosie Project is a first-person romantic story told from the perspective of the hero, Don Tillman. Don is a socially awkward science professor who embarks on a project to find his ideal wife. The Rosie Project has been a huge bestseller, and last year Graham released the sequel, The Rosie Effect. As a special bonus, at the end of our chat, I forced Graham to choose between Team Derek and Team Sebastian. Can you guess which one he picks? You can find information on all the books we talk about in this episode by going to bookthingo.com.au/podcast and clicking on episode number 11. The audio for this podcast was produced by Rudy Bremer. This is a bit of a weird interview, and thank you for joining us. And when I say weird, it's because you write a romantic story, but not completely within the romance genre. And in many ways, you are not an exception, but an unusual kind of author who wrote an unusual kind of book in terms of romance fiction.
Yeah, let me tell you where I was coming from in terms of genre, because it's actually quite straightforward. I was writing the romantic comedy genre, which is really seen as a film genre. And the Rosie Project started out as a screenplay. So from that point of view, it was totally conventional. It sort of ticked all the trope boxes for a rom-com. It was only when I converted it or rewrote it as a novel that there was more of a question about what do we have here? Because romantic comedy is not really a genre, I don't think, in books the same way it is in film. You name books that are structured like a film romantic comedy and you run out very quickly.
It becomes more like chick lit, I think, and also it would not be the book that you were trying to write.
Yeah, that's right. And chick lit, well, if I'm thinking of naming books that are romantic comedies, then Bridget Jones's Diary, I think, fits that. Pretty close. Edition by Tony Jordan is there.
And that's also by text, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I know Tony personally very well. She's actually facilitating a panel with me tomorrow. And then you start to run out very quickly. But, you know, they can list dozens and dozens of films that fit that sort of story. But, of course, once you convert it, once you rewrite it as a novel, you've got all sorts of other things come into play, such as voice. And it would be traditional, I think, for a story of this kind to be told in a female voice if it was first person. And here it is in a male voice.
Which is quite unusual. I mean, I guess Nick Hornby does something similar.
Yeah, Nick Hornby would be, I would see myself as writing in much the same sort of space, if not the same style as Nick Hornby, in that it's about relationships from a male point of view. But I can't think of any of Nick Hornby's books that you would call romantic comedies. They are broadly relationship stories. And frankly, that's what I would say I write. I mean, The Rosie Effect is a story of a domestic relationship, if you like. It's not a romantic comedy arc. It's not a romance arc. It's about people living together and battling all sorts of challenges you have in a relationship. So it just, in a way, that's my genre, that I want to write about relationships, particularly from a male point of view. And it just so happens that the beginning and end of The Rosie Project fits it quite neatly into the romance or romantic comedy genre.
I think the other thing that is a little bit unusual about The Rosie Project is that it's a male protagonist, but it's a romantic story where Don's end goal is to find somebody that he, you know, can marry or be in a long-term relationship with, whereas a lot of the other male-centric romantic stories are around how the men fall in love despite the fact that they actually don't want to have a commitment.
Yeah, that's true. And I think in a way, Don provides, plays the role of the woman in a way, that he's the one who's setting out to find the partner, and Rosie is only reluctantly brought into this. Rosie doesn't want a relationship with Don, and he's got to do all the work. And look, in many ways, that's what you have to do, because if you want the protagonist to have hurdles to get over, so you can't really write it from the point of view of the person who it's all coming to.
So you originally conceived of this story as a rom-com for film. What are your favourite rom-coms?
Oh, that is a really tough question, but I have to say I have a real affection for the old screwball comedies, which preceded the sort of modern rom-com. So things like Bringing Up Baby, The Philadelphia Story, His Girl Friday, and so forth, which, even though we're talking about the 1930s, or even going later, something like The Apartment, which I think is a terrific film, but even given they were in the 30s and so on, they had really strong female characters. And they were also laugh-out-loud funny. So the comedy was full-on comedy. I mean, if you look at a modern, relatively modern style of romantic comedy like, say, Sleepless in Seattle, it's not full of laughs, not in the same way that, say, Bringing Up Baby was. And I was interested in that style, that almost slapstick, and how I could get that under the page and make it work.
Yeah, it's very tricky. If you go too slapstick, then it becomes kind of an absurd story. And I think one of the things that I love about The Rosie Project is that it doesn't go to that point. Like, it doesn't go beyond that point.
It's a very delicate balance. I think it is just slightly hyper-real. So you say, well, it could happen, but probably wouldn't. And look, I do that deliberately early on with the Aspie kids scene, where the kids are all jumping up on the desks in a sort of pseudo homage to Dead Poets Society. And that's my moment where I'm saying to the reader, this is the world we're going to be in. We're going to stretch the point just a little bit. Don is going to learn to dance brilliantly in a week, and so on. And everybody's going to cheer him on the day. We're probably just pushing the credibility thing a little, but not so much, I don't think, that you say, well, that most people would say, oh, forget it. This is ludicrous. But it's just finding that. I'm quite a fan of particularly some of the earlier work of John Irving, The World According to Garp and so forth. And he just hits that slightly hyper-real note as well. And that's what I was trying to do.
And so do you get other people to read it to get a sense of whether or not it goes past that point?
That's not a question I would ask them. But if they came back to me and said, look, this reads absurd or it's not right, I would take that. So it's when you get someone to read it, there's always the open question, what do you think? Is there anything you don't like? But it wouldn't be a specific question.
I heard that you workshopped the story over a few years and it started, as a film sort of idea and then turned into a book. Was it different having to go through sort of the publishing process with the book, or is it a very similar thing to workshopping a film script?
Well, interesting, because by the time I got to a book draft, I put a lot of work and time into it, and the editors didn't mess with it very much. They bought it on the strength of what I had. It's a little different when you get to your second novel and there's a much more interactive sort of thing going on. And really the editors were just saying, we'd like more of this and less of this, rather than doing anything with the book really structurally. So it was quite a different process from the workshopping, where pretty much everything's on the table. I think in screenwriting, there's a strong tradition of writers' rooms where it's collaborative plotting. Now, we didn't quite get to that with the Rosie Project, but people made really strong, big suggestions. And also, it was I was learning, so it was a very embryonic sort of book. It changed almost totally from my first concept and even my first draft screenplay through to what I ended up with at the end. It started as a drama. It became something called the Clara Project. At one point, I threw the whole thing in the bin after 2.5 years of learning, and the only thing I really took out of that bin was Don's personality. And look, I kept a little the jacket incident. There were a few bits and pieces that stayed, but the story changed.
Well, that's interesting, because this is like the breakout debut novel, right? But actually, how many years did it take to craft?
Look, it took, if you count the time that I worked on it as a screenplay, and I think that was a really important time, it was the time that I developed character and stories and so on, then we're looking about 5 to 6 years from the concept to publication. And, I got a certain amount of flack because I was seen as a Johnny come lately to the scene, that I hadn't paid my dues, learned all the stuff. But I'd spent an honest 6 years really working hard to develop as a writer. And before that, I'd written a lot of non-fiction, including a couple of books. And you learn a lot from that too. And, there were people in the literary community who were saying, comparing me with someone like Hannah Kent, for example, who was a debut novelist in the same year as me, in her 20s. And look, you know, without, you know, she did terrific work, but because I think she was in the literary community, there was a sense that she'd paid her dues. But she couldn't possibly have done more learning and work on writing just due to age. I'm 30 years older than her, and over quite a long life, I've done a lot of writing. So I really felt
that. Sensation, yeah, is actually a misnomer, right?
Yeah, so I really felt I had done some work.
So do you read romance?
I don't. I mean, the truth is, I don't read genre romance. Okay. I read love stories from time to time, but I guess it was one of the things I was talking about and didn't really elaborate on today, is that I think the male view of love is less constrained by that courtship sort of thing, that marriage doesn't represent an end point. It you wouldn't want to stop there. The male dream is you know, there's that joke that the observation that the woman's complaint is that the man never changes, and the man's complaint is that the woman does. Yeah, the man wants, you know, often to sustain this sort of thing, and that's a huge challenge. There's always the fear it'll go wrong and so forth. So I think a man, speaking generally, or me at least, would see that story of courtship is just one of many possible relationship stories at different stages in the relationship. So Nick Hornby writes about all different stages in the relationship. I've got a short story out at the moment, which is up online, called Intervention on the Number 3 Tram. And it's a story which goes as far as basically a first date. So it's about that initial recognition, and that's far enough. I don't feel I need to tell you whether they got together and lived happily ever after. So it's just one very, very early stage in a romantic relationship.
So what do you read? What types of novels do you read for leisure?
Look, I read very widely. Having said that I don't read romance, it doesn't mean I wouldn't read any romance. It doesn't mean I wouldn't read any chick lit, for example. But I read a lot because I have to in fiction, or because I'm asked to. Because I've had some success with the Rosie Project, the Rosie Effect, and an endorsement is worth something from me. And I get a lot of publishers and even authors directly coming to me and asking for endorsements. And if we're talking about a new Australian author writing general fiction with an established publisher, or you know, rather than self-publishing generally, then I'm going to make every effort I can to try to read the book and say something to help them along.
You mentioned an edition by Toni Jordan, and I think of that book as the female version of the Rosie Project in many ways, not only because it's published by Tech, but it's to me that there are just some parallels the coincidence is just amazing.
I hadn't read it, and Toni Jordan came along to RMIT. I hadn't met her. She lives just around the corner from me. She came along to RMIT and gave a talk, which was just the most important lecture I've ever heard in my life, because it just played. Suddenly she's standing up there and saying, I had this book. I came out of a marketing background. And I thought, well, yes, I came out of a general business background. And I had this idea for a book, and it's about this woman who's got some mental issues and so forth, some psychological issues. I think, yeah, that's my story. And so, and she's going through all this thing of how she chased down text and got the contract and so forth. I thought, that's my story. And the next thing is, I'm dealing with text. She got her first overseas sales was, to Germany. And same thing with me. That was the big breakthrough. So there's enormous numbers of parallels. Fortunately, I didn't read Edition until after, I think probably after Rosie had been accepted for publication, but certainly well down the track. So there was no cross-fertilisation in content.
No creepy,
but we just, but we found ourselves, we were working in very much the same sort of space. Yeah. And Toni has been a very generous mentor. I was in her class at one stage. She was teaching me at RMIT. And now I would say, a friend and writing colleague.
She is a spectacular mentor, I think, because I believe she also mentored or certainly taught people like Anna Cowan, who wrote a really unusual historical romance. We were having a chat earlier today about readers who are, I guess, kind of split between the readers who are reading the Rosie Project, the series, for Don, and then the readers who are reading it for Rosie.
Yeah, look, I think it's pretty interesting. My expectation when I wrote the Rosie Project was that readers would identify with Don. They would read it for Don. And realizing that Don was potentially a somewhat unsympathetic character because he's a little odd and so forth, I did a lot of writer's tricks, if you like, to give people no other option as to who they identified with. So we don't meet Rosie until well into the book when we should have got our allegiance right. There's no way we're going to connect with Jean. Claudia's not on the page for long enough. So I thought, good, you'll be reading for Don.
So that was very deliberate because I actually, that's one of the things that I thought, oh, I'm not sure I like that.
Yeah, I pushed that very hard. I wanted people to be in Don's head because what I wanted as an outcome from reading that book was that people had travelled a journey with Don and gained some sympathy for where he was coming from. It's a less powerful experience, I would think, to do the journey with Rosie and so on, even though she does make an important journey. But I had reckoned without this gender identification that people have, that people are very inclined to identify with someone of the same gender. I don't get this from my personal experience. If I read Bridget Jones's Diary, I'm in there with Bridget. It's, straightforward. I will identify with the protagonist, be it male or female. That's not the big issue for me, but clearly it is for some people. And I think if your diet of reading almost always has a female protagonist, then at least for some people, there's going to be a tendency to try to find that female in it. People tolerated the Rosie Project. In fact, people came out who did that saying, look, we really enjoyed Rosie's journey, we love Rosie, blah, blah, blah. But the Rosie effect, I lost female readers in that because Rosie's not on the page enough. That's a simple rule. She's not there enough. It's Don's journey. And also, they say, oh, Rosie's not much fun in this book. I made her quite depressed. Mainly because I wanted to explore marriage. I wanted to explore Don's ability to cope with it. And there was no point having a situation where Rosie was doing just fine and help. And every time Don screwed up, she was there to help him. We'd see nothing. We needed Don to be in a situation that anybody is in a relationship at some point where they have to do 90%. Where the other person's struggling and they have to step up to the plate. That had to be the story for me. So Rosie had to be struggling, and I gave her lots of good reasons to be struggling. And but people say, oh yeah, but Rosie, we don't like her. She knew what she was getting herself into. It's only ever women who say this. No man has ever said to me, ever, on Twitter, at a talk, anything, I don't like Rosie in the second book. They say, oh yeah, your partner gets in this tough time, Don has to step up to the mark. But women say she knew what she was getting into, she's let him down, and we all love Don. I think, you're being tough on yourselves, women. This is really tough. But she's off the page, she's not the protagonist, she's doing it tough. And I lost a number of women readers, I think, in that. You just read the Goodreads reviews and so forth. But I picked up a lot of men. And I picked up, I think, probably more of the women in, particularly in relationships or older, but who read generally, as distinct from focus on romance or chick lit with strongly female protagonists.
And are there going to be any more books, Don Tillman books?
Look, one. I think one. Certainly not more than one. I mean, I look at someone like Sue Townsend, who did the Adrian Mole series, and it got to Adrian Mole the prostate years. I mean, it was 8 3/4 at the start of the prostate years. I saw that at my English publisher, Penguin. Like, oh no, I couldn't do this to Don. I can't write this book. How old would I be? I'm 10 years older than Don.
But then once you've written that third book, what's next for you? I mean, I know that there is a film option on the book and that they've cast Rosie,
Jennifer Lawrence,
which is like amazing and exciting.
All the time, people would say, "Who would be your ideal Rosie?" And when I was doing the script, I would say, "I imagine Jennifer Lawrence reading this," and that was how you would do it. Well, my third book in the Don and Rosie series will be a few years away, I think, because we know in the second book that they have a child. I won't give too much spoiler there, but that's what the book's about, and I'd like to give that sort of 7 years or so in literary time and come back, and then we can look at the question of how do you bring up a kid when you're someone like Don, when the kid's maybe someone like Don. Let's go and see that and see how that travels. I mean, I like to tackle, even though these are comedies, I like to tackle important issues in them because I think that provides the backbone and it also makes it worthwhile writing for me. And I don't think in any way that genre stops you from tackling the most important issues. In fact, I would argue that often genre fiction tackles issues that are at least as important, often more important, than what is tackled in literary fiction, where the emphasis may be on the beauty of the prose rather than on the importance of what's actually being the ideas that are being tackled.
I think the other difference is that genre does it with the assumption of optimism, and literary fiction does it with somewhat of an opposite assumption.
Look, that is such an interesting observation, because people have said to me, one of the reasons that the book hasn't done well, hasn't been received as a literary book, and there are some quite strong exceptions to that. It got well nominated for the Dublin Literary Awards. I was really happy about that. But it was because it's got this unrealistic happy ending.
It's too joyful.
It's too joyful. And I say, two things. One, I don't believe the ending is unrealistic. I think that in lots of people do find each other. People do find partners. They do get optimistic about making a relationship. And we don't, in the Rosie Project, look at whether the relationship works or not. We just know they made a decision to give it a go. Well, fantastic. And the other is, you look and say, well, it wouldn't have been very hard to give it an unhappy ending. One page, pretty much. It would have been,
There would be no book, right?
It would have been trivial to give it an unhappy ending. And if that made people feel it was a more literary book, but it wasn't the book I wanted to write. But it seems that almost a trivial thing that its literary standing could be affected by the fact that you twisted the ending to say, and they both walked away sadder and no wiser.
Annie Hall.
For literary and genre to just be, like, to not have that divide, to say there can be good writing in genre, and there can be a preoccupation with writing in genre, and literary fiction can be joyful, and it'll be fine.
Yeah, look, the genre I know best is romantic comedy, and you can say the most profound things in romantic comedy. You can tackle the most important ideas in romantic comedy, and there's nothing to stop you writing, if you're in a novel, the most beautiful prose, the most poetic prose.
Well, I still remember that one scene in The Rosie Project where I'm not going to be able to quote it word for word, but I know there was a scene where Rosie was basically waiting for Don to tell her, I think, that he loved her or that she was beautiful, and he just didn't know how to express it. And so the moment passed, and he knew that the moment had passed, but he just had no language for it, which I, even now when I think of that whole book, that's the one scene that I always remember, and I have felt the most emotionally connected to.
Well, look, different people have responded to that, in different ways, and they found the most, the part that they laugh the most at, they cry the most at, whatever. But I'm certainly trying to connect with people emotionally and intellectually. And, there are some, I don't want to sort of put tabs on myself here. It's a romantic comedy, but there are ideas of identity and of idealism and so forth, which are quite consciously in that book. If people want to see them, that's fine. If people want to read it, it's a very simple story of romance on the beach, that's totally fine too. But the structure, a genre structure, can carry some very powerful ideas without distracting the reader with wondering, about the structure.
So we've run out of time, but because the romance community has adopted you as one of our own, no matter whether or not your book is... No. I wanted to give you like a quick question, like, one of those questions where I just ask you the question and you give an answer. I'm not sure if you will get the context for some of these because they're quite romance-y things. So, vampires or werewolves?
Werewolves.
Dukes or scoundrels?
Scoundrels.
Derek or Sebastian?
Derek.
Thank you so much for your time. So there you have it. Graham Simsion is Team Derek. Though to be honest, I'm not sure he knew what that was all about, but he was a good sport. Huge thanks and chocolate offerings to our amazing audio producer, Rudy Bremer. The show notes for this episode are at bookthingo.com.au/podcast. Just click on episode 11. You can also visit Bookthingo to check out reviews and opinions from a bunch of readers from down under, including me and Rudy. I've just looked up my review of The Rosie Project, and this is what I wrote. This book has the right combination of humour, mayhem, and sweetness to appeal to a broad audience. Reading this book is fun, but it's also filled with bits of science and observations that challenge conventional thinking. You can read the rest on the blog. If you have any feedback or suggestions, please send an email to podcast@bookthingo.com.au. I'd love to hear from you. And if you'd like to leave a rating or review on iTunes,
Well, clearly you are an amazing person. Make sure you check back in a couple of weeks for the next episode. Until then, I hope you have a fabulous fortnight of reading.